Good afternoon, and welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. You may not believe it's me because I'm hoarse, and I'll ask you to just bear with us, but we're going to be going on as usual. Pain, discomfort, and concerns about our feet are very common. Today, we'll address all of these concerns, or many of these concerns, I should say, and answer your questions about disorders of the foot and ankle. My guest today is Anchorage podiatrist Dr. Ken Swayman. If you've got questions or comments, there's several ways to reach us. There's toll-free number 550-8433. I'm sorry, that's our Anchorage number, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And you can email us at line1@ksk.org. Ken, it's good to have you here again. This is, you said you were doing this with Joanne Chasman, who preceded me in this program more than 10 years ago, and you were doing appearances and talking about podiatry even then.
Yeah, that's correct.
And you've been with Alaska Foot Alliance of Foot and Ankle here in Anchorage for 1993. And I should also mention, although his office is at Regional Hospital, he is a staff member at Providence and Health South, so he can do surgery at those facilities as well.
Correct.
All right. Let me just start by asking you in general, what are the most common issues that a podiatrist deals with?
Well, just about anything you can imagine that can go wrong with the foot, ankle, and leg, you know, from the dermatological standpoint, the skin and the nails. There are a lot of fungal, bacterial, viral infections of the skin of the foot. The virus, we're talking about warts. You know, fungus, we're talking about athlete's foot, and onychomycosis, which is a fungal disorder of the nail. Abnormalities of the nail can commonly present as an ingrown nail, with or without the presence of infection. And then as you go deeper in the foot and ankle, you know, there's nerves, there's muscles and tendons. I deal with a lot of sports-related injuries, strains of tendons, ruptures of tendons, overuse injuries of soft tissue structures like the muscles and the tendons. And then, of course, down to the bone and the joints. A lot of arthritic problems, which are progressive and quite debilitating, fractures, dislocations, just to name a few.
All right. I'm going to start with some issues that have been in my office somewhat frequently recently. And I want to remind our listeners, if you've got questions about the feet, you can help yourself by calling in or emailing our local number 550-8433 and our email line1@kska.org, and you can get your questions answered. And it'll also help me because I'm straining with this voice today. So the more you guys call in and ask your questions, you get both of us are going to win a little bit. I won't have to talk so much. I recently saw a teen girl who had a significant bunion problem, and I referred her actually to you for your opinion. What is a bunion? How common is it in childhood and adolescence? And what are the options for treatment?
Okay, good question. A bunion is an actual physiological change to the great toe joint. It's called the first metatarsal phalangeal joint or the big toe joint. And it typically will present with some kind of a physical bump. The bump can be on the inside, which we call the medial aspect of the foot, in this case of the big toe joint. It could be on the top, or it can be kind of in between those two. And it's actually an inherited condition. You are born with certain foot types, and certain foot types have a higher propensity to develop a bunion. The medical term for bunion is called hallux valgus. Hallux is the medical term for the big toe, and the valgus is the positional change that happens to the joint. Basically, two things occur. These bones in the ball of the foot called the metatarsals, we have five of them. They're numbered 1 to 5, corresponding to the first to fifth toe, and they have a certain orientation in relation to each other. And in a normal scenario, these bones are kind of parallel to each other. If the first and second metatarsal, which corresponds to the first and second toe, start to splay apart, otherwise the angle gets wider, the bump on the inside of the toe appears bigger. And this is usually progressive over time. So if someone has a genetic propensity to develop this, and it could be due to a foot type that's very flexible, a foot type that's very flat, a foot type that we call hypermobile, and you add in environmental situations such as shoes, activities, this progression of the angle increases. And the wider the angle between the first and second metatarsal, the bigger the bump. And then another process occurs that actually deviates the big toe over towards the second toe. And that has to do with these tiny little bones on the bottom of the big toe joint called the sesamoids. They're analogous to little tiny kneecaps, and we all have two of them. And when they're in their proper alignment and position, they basically reduce friction underneath the big toe joint so that when we walk, we don't develop horrendous calluses under our big toe because that's kind of the last area the foot touches the ground in weight-bearing before we swing our foot to the next phase of gait. So if the sesamoids are not working properly, you're going to develop big callus. When these sesamoids shift, you start to have the big toe deviate. So in a nutshell, that's what hallux valgus is. It's a separation of the metatarsals and deviation of the sesamoids, resulting in a bump and a deviation of the big toe towards the second toe. The treatment is typically based on symptoms. Not every bunion or hallux valgus needs to be surgically corrected. If the symptoms warrant such, then it is a reasonable thing to consider. Non-surgical options would be choosing shoes that accommodate the width of the forefoot because naturally the foot is going to get wider due to the bump, putting different type of insert devices in the shoes to eliminate the abnormal motion that caused it in the first place. And typically that's a condition called hyperpronation. There's a lot of advertisements as far as bunion splints and shields and night splints, and the reality is that there's no science behind this. You can't correct this physiological change with some kind of a splintage. The only thing that will correct it definitively is surgery. But surgery is usually reserved for people where the non-surgical options, such as shoes, inserts, short course of anti-inflammatory medications or different type of physical therapy modalities are ineffective, and it's affecting the quality of their ambulatory life, both with work and recreation.
So this problem is often found within families since it's hereditary, or is it genetic but not necessarily more sporadic in its occurrence?
Both. I mean, there are certainly skipped generations that can occur just right. with many inherited maladies. But typically we will see if a parent has a hallux valgus or a bunion, it's not unusual that, you know, one or more of their children will have it. Doesn't mean they'll, again, be symptomatic.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it sounds a little bit like scoliosis. We know what happens. We know what happens in families, but we're not sure exactly why. You've theorized that it may have something to do with loose joints or the way our foot is, but, I mean, you can argue pronation is due to loose joints and, you know, which came first and
correct.
So forth. And,
correct.
And so the bottom line is prevention is difficult, but common sense, having large toe boxes on shoes and so forth is appropriate. But it may be that, and you tell me if I'm wrong, no matter what we do, we may progress, and if you're going to do something, you make a decision about surgery. How do you make the decision to go to surgery? Is it basically a personal choice?
Well, typically it's how the deformity is affecting the quality of one's life. Many patients, you know, have what may be defined as mild to moderate clinical deformities. In other words, you look at them and you go, yeah, it's a bump. But, you know, they're running 30, 40 miles a week, or they're playing hockey or basketball or tennis, whatever their sport is. In other words, it's not affecting the quality of their life. So in that sense, if the deformity is actually progressive in forming degenerative disease of the joint, one may take a more aggressive approach surgically. If the integrity of the joint on x-ray and followed by x-ray and clinically, of course, meaning physical exam, they're not having stiffness, they're not having joint swelling, there isn't that sense of urgency. A hallux valgus or a bunion isn't going to make someone crippled, overnight. It is a progressive issue, though. So in other words, if I see a kid that's 16, 17, 18 and has it, but they're functioning fine, they learn about what it is, they become educated on the whole entity, and, you know, what can they do as far as choices in shoes and inserts and, choosing prolonged barefooted activities to try to, slow down the progression, so to speak. But you can't slow it down. It is going to progress. And then when it became an issue that you know, affected the quality of their work or their you know, livelihood, or even some people choose to do surgery because they just can't choose shoes. Mm. They're very limited. I can't wear a tennis shoe every day, you know, and that would be an indication.
Is pain very much a part of this or not, as much as you might expect?
It can be. Uh-huh. It can be. I mean, many people that have huge hallux valgus deformities come in because, you know, the second toe is being pushed up because the big toe is deviating over, and they get a big callus or a corn on the top of the second toe. Okay. And you say, well, what is hurting you the most? You know, what is it that we could do to make you comfortable? Well, fix that second toe. Mm-hmm. It's not even the bunion. Yeah. The bunion caused that other issue.
Right.
It makes it a little more of a challenge as far as deciding on what to do, because if you address the secondary issue, in this particular example, the second toe, you need to fix the bunion as well, because if you straighten out the second toe and the deforming force that led to that is still present, you can count on a recurrence.
Yeah. So it's okay. All right. We've got a couple callers, so let's take advantage of them. And Peter, you're on line one.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much for taking my call. My question really is that I'm diagnosed with stage 4 hallux rigidus on my left toe. I worry a little bit about having it on the right toe because I'm an ex-championship country western dancer. And the therapy that I have right now, and I've had this painful left toe for years. I currently have grade orthotics, which have a carbon fiber plate in them, and I get around fine as long as I'm wearing those. And I'm looking at having an orthopedic surgery. The surgery I'm concerned about is, I think it's called chilation versus a fusion of the toe. I want to be able to dance again, and I'm not sure if fusing the toe is the best thing, if I can keep dancing on it. So I'm looking at this chilation procedure, which I guess takes all the spurs and everything off of it. I'm afraid of losing bone from that surgery that later on I might not be able to get a fusion for. So help me out here.
Well, good point. And your story is something I'll see at least 3 to 6 times a day. Hallux limitus or hallux rigidus, by definition, hallux again being the medical term for the big toe, is a progressive stiffening and degenerative joint disease or osteoarthritis of the big toe joint. It's a stage condition from 1 to 4. It's 8 to 1 times more common in men than women, and typically more in active people. So as you get into higher stages, basically the stages are defined by clinically the joint gets stiffer. There's a lot of excessive bone building around it because, in essence, the body is trying to fuse the joint for you. When the cartilage, the articular cartilage that you see on both sides of the joint, which typically is this pearl white, you know, slick tissue, degenerates away, that's basically what arthritis is. So it's a slow progression towards autofusion. Your body is fusing it for itself, because if the joint fuses, in theory, you can't have any pain anymore. Now, in the ideal scenario, the big toe should flex up about 65 degrees and down about 20 degrees for normal function. Obviously, with hallux limitus leading up to hallux rigidus, that motion is eliminated. And if you have been told you're in stage 4, which is the end stage, you probably have minimal to no motion at all. And the pain is from that micro motion that has poor quality. There's probably multiple fragments of bone floating around in the joint. There may be pieces of cartilage that have been floating in the joint. And then you have this chronic inflammatory condition called capsulitis, which is the envelope around the joint being aggravated by all these conditions that are occurring. Chylectomy is the term that we use to go in and basically clean off the spurs, remove any loose fragments of bone. We call them osteochondral bodies. They're also referred to as joint mice, little tiny pieces of bone or cartilage that have been floating around in this fluid-filled cavity called the joint. You could think of it as small little rocks floating on a beach in a tide pool, and the water is actually causing the little rocks to create gouges in the bigger rocks, and that's what's occurring in the joint, and that's what commonly occurs with hallux rigidus, hallux limitus condition. These small little fragments create gouges and progression, further degeneration in the joint because the fluid is moving them around. Stage 4, hallux limitus, hallux rigidus, or end stage, there's not much we can reconstruct because if I could catch someone in stage 2 or early to mid-stage 3, there are certain procedures we can do to realign the joint, basically reconstruct the joint, and basically knock someone back a stage to a stage and a half, and prolong the inevitable, such as fusion, for maybe a decade or more. The end result of people with hallux limitus, if one lives long enough, will be fusion. It'll be fusion that the body does on its own, or you may elect to have it done surgically. A chylectomy and a fusion are two totally different things. The chylectomy is basically going in there, leaving the joint intact, but cleaning up as much degenerative disease as you physically can. There may not be smooth, good quality of motion afterwards, but there'll be some. And you are right that part of the joint is debulked, and you do lose a certain amount of bone. And depending on which practitioner is doing the procedure, they may be more aggressive in the amount of bone they decide to resect. A fusion or an arthrodesis, on the other hand, basically says there's no joint cartilage left. We open up this joint, and there's nothing pearl white or shiny there. It's basically bone on bone. The joint is remodeled, and the joint is put in a position of function. And it's based on what is the typical heel height the person wears. Typically in a man, it's, you know, an inch or less. And then that's how we determine where to place the toe. And usually large screws are placed across the joint. The person is then non-weight-bearing for a period of time, typically a month to a month and a half, and the joint fuses solid. The outcome should be no pain, because now the joint can't physically move. And as long as the joint is in a position of function, all activities should be a lot more comfortable, including, you know, a dance or any kind of sport. If one does have a chylectomy in a stage 4 hallux limitus, in my mind, I would not be removing that much bone to disturb the integrity, so that if later on, and it could be a year, it could be 5 years, an arthrodesis or fusion is needed, that you are correct that there is enough bone to have an effective fusion that has the capacity to heal. One of the risks of having the fusion is non-healing. We call that a delayed or non-union. And you do need enough bone surface for the two pieces to come together and fuse as one.
So the caller took this answer offline, and if I was him, I would be saying the options are often very clear. The experience and the willingness of the provider to really understand what the patient wants and expects and needs is really where things start getting where the rubber meets the road in getting this thing done right.
Correct. There's a big difference in the postoperative rehab for a chylectomy versus a fusion. For instance, a chylectomy, immediate weight bearing is allowed next day.
Yeah.
With a fusion, you're looking at a month to a month and a half. Mm-hmm. Chylectomy, you know, can be dramatic, but it's not a cure.
Okay. So tell me if I'm wrong. My advice would be to not be afraid to get a second opinion and really discuss with the provider that's going to be doing this. Make sure you're both on the same page about what your expectations are and what you hope to accomplish and what the natural history and outcome of this problem is going to be anyway.
Absolutely.
Okay, dope. Julie, you're our next guest on Line 1. What can we do for you?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'd like the doctor to explain anatomically what a Morton neuroma is and what things you can do day-to-day to help with the pain. And lastly, if you do need surgery, what the success rates of surgery are in his experience. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you so much.
All right, thanks for your call.
All right, good question. A neuroma, by definition, is a benign enlargement or swelling of a nerve. The nerves in the foot are essentially the furthest extensions of your spinal cord. Essentially, the spinal column ends kind of in the back of the buttock area and then divides into two main branches that go to the left and right lower extremity. And on their way down to the lower leg and the foot, they have multiple branches that divide. They have multiple functions, motor function to muscles, to vessels, to skin, to joint. They make a turn, they go underneath the foot, and they're working their way out to their furthest extension, and that's the tips of the toes to give sensation around the toenail. Well, in the process, they have to pass through some very narrow channels. And earlier, we were talking about bunions, and I mentioned about metatarsals, which are the long little club bones in the ball of the foot. The spaces between the metatarsals are called the intermetatarsal spaces. When these nerves are traveling through these intermetatarsal spaces on their final destination to the tips of the toes, certain inflammatory changes can occur. The nerve could be pinched from a swollen bursa, which is a sac of fluid that's in the ball of the foot. Certain muscles or tendons can inflame and essentially pinch or choke off this nerve so that it doesn't function physiologically normal anymore. The nerve then actually changes. It swells. It becomes thicker. And it actually has to do with the cells on the outside of the nerve that enlarge. So by definition, this neuroma is just an enlargement of a nerve due to some kind of an event. It's typically mechanical in the foot. The most common place it occurs in the foot is between the third and fourth toes in the ball of the foot, because a lot of motion occurs along this, we call it an axis. It's an uneven axis because on one side of the axis you have three toes, that being toes 1, 2, and 3, and then on the other you have toes 4 and 5. So along this axis between the third and fourth metatarsal, a lot of motion activity occurs, and it's very common. Morton was just a gentleman doctor many, many years ago that described this, wrote an article, and out of respect for him, we still call it a Morton's neuroma, but that's just the initial defining. So you could call it neuroma, Morton's neuroma, in interchangeable terminology. Morton's neuroma can be treated non-surgically. It's a rather straightforward diagnosis on physical exam. You don't see neuroma on an x-ray. You could see it on an ultrasound or an MRI, but usually those are unnecessary tests. The diagnosis is usually a clinical exam to determine it. And the non-surgical measures are to get weight off the ball of the foot. So usually an orthosis, an orthotic foot plate, is put in the shoe to take weight off the ball of the foot, move it back to the arch. A standard of care, usually before surgery, is to inject around the nerve with anti-inflammatory corticosteroids. And this may take 1, 2, 3 injections over a period of 6 to 12 months. Physical therapy can help. If all these measures fail, usually resection can be considered. In my experience, more than half, I would say more like 60 to 70% of people that have Morton's neuroma do not need surgery for this. The ones that do, there's two options. You can resect the nerve out, which is called a neurectomy, or you can decompress the tissue around the nerve that's causing the choking of the nerve, if you would, or the pinching of the nerve, if you would. The problem with those procedures is if they have recurrence, you say, man, we're already there. We should have just taken the nerve out. So it's a kind of a judgment call. Taking the nerve out doesn't have that much residual disability. It may be an area of numbness, the diameter of a quarter to a half a dollar. The nerve is strictly sensory at that point, so you don't lose muscle function. You just may have a sense of numbness in the area, where that nerve was innervating or giving the sensation. But there's a process called recruitment that occurs, and what that means is the adjacent nerves to the left or to the right of it will send branches in so that some of this numbness can compensate. There's about a 10% complication rate when you cut a nerve out. And typically what can happen is when you cut a nerve, you create what we refer to as a stump. Well, the inner guts of a nerve, they're called axons, and that's the housing or the piping, if you would, that carries all the energy that and information that the nerve does. The axons want to hook up with the other portion that was cut. And these axons grow into the scar tissue, and they kind of form these large loops and lumps, and you can get a condition called a stump or an amputation neuroma. And that could be as painful as the initial problem. It doesn't happen often, thankfully. And if it does, there are remedies for it, both non-surgical and even revisional surgical procedures. But that's kind of the overview of neuroma.
All right. So the natural history of Morton's neuroma is that many of these will resolve with appropriate management without surgery.
More than half.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Another caller. Wayne, you've been patiently waiting. What can we do for you?
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. I on my right foot, I have a bunion, which is such to the point that the big toe is pushed in toward the second toe. It's moved me up to a quadruple E shoe. And along with that, under my fourth toe, right at the main joint where it hooks to the foot, every month I get this very thick callus that becomes painful. And I cut it off with a razor blade or a knife. It's usually about, you know, like a quarter of an inch thick. And then that's, I'm fine. And it grows back. And I'm just wondering if maybe that bunion is related to that callus forming under that other toe.
Which toe did you say is growing under again?
It is the one next to the pinky.
Okay. Well, certainly when you have a large bunion or hallux valgus and the big toe is deviated over and it's pushing the second toe against the adjacent toes, there can be structural changes to the toes that occur. If a toe isn't functioning in what we call straight sagittal plane, meaning straight up and down, the fat pad on the bottom of the toe can shift. When that little fat pad shifts, it's not uncommon to get what we call a linear callus ridge. It's very firm. It's almost like a hard rope-like structure. And softening it with callus softening creams, trimming it, I'd be real careful as far as, you know, home surgery techniques. I've seen a lot of people, cause inadvertent self-harm by cutting too deep or seeding infection. I think it's much safer until someone looks at it and kind of gives you formal instruction. If you felt the need to cut on it yourself, you could pick up over-the-counter they're called keratolytic creams, and basically they're softening agents that soften hard skin. They're not necessarily acids. They're creams that go on and create a softening. And then you can, you know, kind of file it down with a piece of, clean, fine sandpaper or an emery board or a pumice stone. That would be a safer way to go than using some kind of a home knife. But yes, toes can change their position due to bunions crowding the toes in your shoes, and that is not an unusual finding.
All right, thank you.
Thank you for calling, Wayne. All right, we're going to take a short break. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection in Anchorage. Remember, our number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can email us at line1@kska.org. After this break, we'll continue to answer your questions and discuss foot and ankle problems with Anchorage podiatrist Dr. Ken Swayman. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen to Line 1, Your Health Connection again, tune in tonight at 8. Remember, tonight's recorded rebroadcast will not be taking telephone calls. Following this afternoon's broadcast, Line 1 will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Anchorage podiatrist Dr. Ken Swayman. If you've got questions or comments about any foot and ankle problem, we strongly recommend you give us a call or email us. You can email us at line1, all one word, spelled out, at kska.org, or you can give us a call at 550-8433. Outside of Anchorage, our number is 1-888-353-5752. And always remember, if you're listening between 8 and 9, you're listening to a rebroadcast of a recorded version of this program. And also, I'd like to point out to those of you who may not know it, at any time, you can go to kska.org/line1 and look at our archives and listen to other previous programs. And you can do that even while you're on vacation. All right. Ken, we have still got phone calls coming in. I've got a person named Adam on line 10, so let's ask Adam what his problem is. Adam, what can we do for you?
Well, I have a friend who has, he's been a longtime snowboarder, and so I'm assuming that this problem might go with any kind of snug-fitting athletic or any kind of snug-fitting footwear. But his small toe, his pinky toe, will swell to about the size of my thumb by, say, December. And so we call it his potato because his little toe grows maybe threefold over the course of the first couple months of winter. So I was curious if you had ever even seen that before.
And I guess it resolves over the summer when he's not snowboarding.
Right. He goes back into mountain bike shoes, and it's fine, even though they're still pretty snug-fitting athletic shoes. It goes away.
It's my understanding also that the snowboarders probably don't cram their feet into unbelievably small boots like downhill racers.
I wouldn't say unbelievably. They're definitely not soccer shoes, but they're snug.
Okay.
Well, it's interesting. There could be a lot of reasons why. Does it happen on just one foot or both?
Yeah, I think it started on his left foot, and now it's both.
Well, you know, the first thing I would do in a situation like that is, you know, I would test his vasculature to make sure that he's getting both adequate inflow and outflow. That, you know, swelling could be caused by fluid getting into the toe and not being able to be released. It'd be interesting to see an X-ray to see if there's any kind of irregularity to the phalange bones in his toe that get basically aggravated by the sport. It's an interesting phenomenon. It's not a common one. And the fact that it completely subsides would say that it's situational to the sport. So it could be that he's just putting too much pressure on the side of his foot, and that's creating the swelling. But it would be impossible to guess why is the swelling occurring, you know, without, you know, getting some studies, X-ray and these vascular studies and possibly even an MRI of the toe to, you know, see what's going on inside there.
Yeah, he says it is quite painful.
Yeah, I mean, it may be something to look at. I mean, you know, one of the consequences of doing nothing, if there is some kind of vascular problem and there's not enough fluid getting in or not the fluid getting out, you know, it could be some permanent tissue damage. So it is something I would look into.
Yeah, I'm going to forward him the podcast of this episode.
Yep, give him our URL and he can listen to it. But that's good advice.
Okay, thanks a lot.
You bet.
You're welcome.
We've got a couple of callers on the line, but I've got several emails, and I want to do the emails since I think they came in before the callers. And if we don't get to everybody, I apologize ahead of time. So here's an email I got even before we came on the air. It has to do with plantar fasciitis. What is plantar fasciitis? Is this a condition that's treated by podiatrists? I bought some orthotics from a local shoe store, and they told me it would take about 6 months to heal. I don't want to wait 6 months and find out that I should have seen somebody else and done something else.
Well, plantar fasciitis is probably one of the most common injuries that I see of the foot. It can occur in both athletic and the sedentary population. Essentially, plantar just means the bottom of the foot. The fascia is analogous to a rubber band-like structure. It's very white, shiny, and rope-like in real life. And it begins on the bottom of the heel bone called the calcaneus, where it's its thickest, largest, and widest. And it travels basically to the ball of the foot, and then it thins out and becomes tissue under the toes. The job of the fascia is, among other things, is to help maintain the longitudinal arch of the foot. If there's some kind of pathological motion where the foot kind of rolls inward, we call hyperpronation. Pronation is a normal motion to absorb shock along with the knee bending and the leg rotating in. It's the hyperpronation, it's the excessive pronation that creates a lengthening of the foot. If you think of the foot as just an arch, and if the arch collapses, essentially the point A to point B, being the end of the foot to the end of the heel, is going to become a longer distance. This fascia stretches out. And it's the micro injury where the thickest part of the fascia attaches to the bottom of the heel bone that creates this inflammatory process. And that's why you put itis on the end of the medical term, means inflammation. You could have an itis of any part of your body. Plantar fasciitis just means an inflammation of this ligament. Or it's not really a ligament, it's called a deep fascia. It's basically an organized layer of deep fat. So it's very common. It's very, very treatable. This is not an exaggeration. I probably see 10 people a day that have plantar fasciitis. That might not be the primary problem they come to see me, but it's, you know, oh, by the way, before I walk out of the room, you know, my heel hurts, by the way, you know, and, you know, that's another 20 minutes of me teaching them stuff. But I would have to say in my clinical experience, 98%, 97, 98, 99%, that high, it is treatable, non-surgical. You have to identify the abnormal cause, and if it is hyperpronation, deal with that. It may be that people have to be educated on the shoes they wear. They may have to limit their barefoot walking, and that even includes indoors while they're having the acute symptoms. Orthotic therapy is considered a gold standard to create a more of a stable arch. Stretching, splintage at night to keep the foot from flexing down, oral anti-inflammatory medication, either in pill or injectable form, and physical therapy, either self-directed or in the hands of a professional physical therapist. Most of these modalities will work. As far as putting a timeline on it, it depends. If a person is diagnosed and treated within the acute phase, meaning 3 months or less, it's fair to make a prognosis that it would be resolved quicker. If someone has had it in what we call the chronic phase, which would be defined as 3 months or greater, it may take longer to resolve because of the amount of inflammation and possible degeneration of the fascia. So to put a timeline on it, I think may be unrealistic. It's a case-by-case basis.
Second part of the question, and from this caller who said she's got plantar fasciitis. I've been told I have pronated feet. Did this add to the risk of plantar fasciitis, and what's the best treatment for this? I'm not able to stand long periods of time or take long walks without being uncomfortable. I've invested in good quality walking shoes, but I'm thinking I might need more.
Well, pronated, to say someone has a pronated foot, you know, if you ask 10 different foot specialists, what does that mean? You may get 10 different answers. Pronation is a motion that occurs where the foot rolls in. Specifically, it involves the joint in the hind foot called the subtalar joint, but below the ankle. So a foot type is not, you know, in my opinion, you wouldn't say a foot type is pronated. A foot type has a more propensity to be hyperpronation motion occurring. A more proper term would be maybe a foot that's in what we call plano valgus or a flat foot than to say pronation, because again, that's describing a motion as opposed to a structure. A flexible flat foot certainly has a higher propensity or likelihood to develop plantar fasciitis due to the fact that the inside or medial arch, the side by the big toe, is usually more unstable, more flexible. And when you watch these people walk, their foot basically rolls into the inside. So it's a pronatory motion or a pronatory movement as opposed to a pronated foot type.
Okay. Now here's a question that I don't think I've ever addressed on this program before. And see if you can figure this one out. It says, this is a woman, I believe, who's calling them. Yes. And it says, I have a fatty tumor on my right foot. It's growing toward the right side of my right foot and is located in front of my ankle. It's about the size of a ping pong ball. It's not discolored, feels slightly spongy to touch, not hard. It does not interfere with shoes. It's been growing slowly over the years. Is this something I should be concerned about?
Well, a soft tissue mass or a neoplasm is common in the foot and something I see every day in a handful of people. For one to say I have a fatty tumor as a self-diagnosis, we're uncertain of that because there are certain clinical signs that we look for. A fatty tumor, by definition, is called a lipoma, and that's just basically a benign growth of the superficial adipose, so superficial fat. Basically, you know, you cut through the skin, and there's this kind of yellowy tissue we call the superficial adipose. If that forms a lump, that would be a lipoma. So if someone told this individual, you have a fatty tumor, a lipoma, well, that is a possibility. I think more common than a lipoma in front of the ankle, it would be a ganglionic type cyst or synovial cyst, which is, in fact, a fluid-filled cavity. And the reason I say this is the area in front of the ankle commonly forms this little cyst or balloon that comes off the front of the ankle joint and is fed with fluid from inside the joint. I much more commonly see ganglionic or synovial cysts in front of the ankle as opposed to lipoma. But that being said, you could stick a needle in the lesion and see if you can draw fluid. You can get an MRI study. The ultimate diagnosis would be biopsy, either incisional, meaning you take a piece of it out to determine what it is, or an excisional biopsy, basically remove the whole darn thing and have the pathology guys tell us what it is.
Overall, your suggestion would be somebody ought to see this thing.
Yes, especially if it's getting bigger over time.
Okie doke. I'm going to take a phone call now. Peggy, you're on line one. Peggy's still there? Nope. All right. Back to our emails. Here's one that says, I've got a beginning of hammer toes on my left foot. Once I noticed this, I started stretching the tendons on that foot for several minutes every day. Now I no longer have the pressure points on the tops of my toes that had developed over time. Still, my toes remain somewhat bent. Is there anything more I can do? Is stretching really helping, or is it only my wishful thinking?
Well, a hammer toe is basically a contracture of the phalange bones of the toes. The phalanges are the toe of the finger bones, two in the big toe with the thumb, three in toes, two to five, as in fingers two to five. When you have these toes contract or bend, we term that a hammer toe position. A hammer toe can be defined as a supple or a flexible hammer toe, meaning it bends when you stand and weight bear, but one can physically straighten them out manually, or you can develop what's called rigid or stiff hammer toes, where the joint actually ankyloses. It physically changes, and the toe cannot bend down. All flexible hammer toes potentially, over time, can develop into rigid hammer toes. There's no way to know. A standard of care would be choosing shoes that are wide enough in the toe box to not create pressure points on the tips or the top where the knuckle bends, putting inserts in the shoe. See, basically, a hammer toe is a condition that results from a faulty motion. The tendons on the bottom and the top are no longer in dynamic harmony, and when one tendon has a mechanical advantage, it starts to pull in that direction. So in a foot type, getting back to this thing, a pronated foot versus a pronatory motion type foot, a hyperpronatory foot type that rolls in a lot, due to the way the tendons pull abnormally in that motion, and we, you know, you get into, like, when you study this stuff, it becomes a little bit of physics and math and vectors. It's the way the tendons pull, and certain tendons pull in an abnormal way due to the abnormal motion of the foot, and they start giving these tendons mechanical advantage. So understanding that concept, if you're stretching out the toes, you may get what appears to be an initial bounce, and they may feel a little more supple. But really, the standard of care in the non-surgical arena is not stretching out the toe, but rather dealing with the mechanical environment that's leading to this contracture.
Okay. All right. Another caller, if you don't mind. Nellie, you're on line one.
Yes, I was diagnosed about 4 years back with neuropathy of both feet. At that time, there was kind of an offer of surgery or pills, both which were kind of drastic. And I decided just to deal with the pain. And I'm still dealing with it. Just wondered if you have any insight as to this new supposedly laser treatment that is supposed to be available now?
Well, different people have different types of neuropathy. Neuropathy can be caused by certain medical or endocrine conditions, diabetes.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes.
Are you diabetic?
Tamoxifen.
Okay. So there are different types of neuropathy. There's what we call sensory neuropathy, where you lose the ability to feel light touch, and some of the symptoms associated with that could be burning, tingling, pins and needles. There could be motor neuropathy, where you actually lose function of the muscles and actually have structural changes of the toes, like hammer toes we were just talking about. There's neuropathy that can affect the joints. We call that osteoarthropathy, or Charcot changes, where the foot actually goes through major changes in appearance due to the lack of proprioception of the joints. And then there's a fourth type of neuropathy called autonomic neuropathy that affects in the foot and leg, which is what I see, the skin, the temperature, the moisture of the skin. Autoneuropathy affects a lot of other things higher up on the body as well. But it sounds like, you know, you're dealing with the sensory component of neuropathy. Now, when neuropathy is caused as a side effect of certain drug therapies, it could be transitory, meaning once that offending drug therapy is stopped or altered in its dosage, one may not have the neuropathy anymore. While this is occurring, you do have several options. The medication options typically involve three drugs, Lyrica, Cymbalta, and Neurontin. And they're all good drugs, and one drug may work well with one person and not the other. They are safe. They have low side effect profiles, not to say that one can't get side effects. And usually using these drugs for a period of time while one is taking a medication that's led to the sensory neuropathy, or let's say it's a diabetic, or let's say it's an alcoholic that has sensory neuropathy, and they say, I can't sleep at night, my feet burn, or just the tingle. We use these medications, and along with other type of local therapies, physical therapies and desensitization therapies, quite effectively. Surgery, you know, laser, I have to admit, I don't know much about that. It's not something I do in the reading that I've done on it. It's not, I think, an accepted standard of care. There are surgeries to physically change the way nerves make turns around certain angles around the outside of the knee, on the top of the foot, and these are effective if the nerve is being kind of choked off or pinched, so to speak. So it's, again, on a case-by-case basis how one would treat a neuropathy. You know, usually medication therapy would be tried first, followed by some kind of physical therapy or injection therapy, leaving the surgical options as kind of a last resort.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your information, and I'll go from there.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. Bye.
Another email, Ken. We got 10 minutes or so, it looks like. What have you seen or heard any relationship between foot and ankles and restless leg syndrome?
Well, yes, as far as, you know, the pain and the spasms, but as far as direct correlation where, you know, you have a foot or ankle ailment, meaning that's going to lead to restless leg or vice versa, I can't correlate any studies, nor do I have, direct clinical experience I could cite. Yeah. But yes, they can occur concomitantly together.
Mm-hmm. But cause and effect is what we're not sure of, and we're not sure what the question is.
Yeah, it's a case-by-case basis, right. And you'd have to see, you know, what is the issues of the foot and ankle, how severe is the restless leg, are they getting any remedy with medication therapy, physical therapy, stretching therapy, splintage therapy. You know, it's a good question, but it's a little broad for me to give a definitive answer on that.
Okay. Hugh, what can we do for you?
Hi. A couple callers ago, a fella mentioned about his fourth toe on his left foot. Same issue with the callus, and he was peeling it off, whatever. But I have a pinky toe, the same foot, you know, the big toe on the left foot, growing inward or moving inward over the years, and super painful, excruciatingly painful, at the point where I got to, like, stop whatever I'm doing and pull it apart from the fourth toe. And I was just curious what causes that pain, and is there any way to make that pain go away besides Advil or whatever? So I'll just take my call off the air. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, you know, if one has what we call a hammer toe fifth, where there's an actual flexion contracture and curvature of the fifth toe, and a direct skin lesion has resulted from this, we commonly refer to it as a corneal callus. Medically, we refer to them as holoma. Holomas are very thickened areas of the skin due to sheer friction on an area. It could be that the fifth toe is bent and rotated, rubs on the outside of the shoe, and you get this corner callus on the top upper outside of the knuckle joint of the fifth toe. It could be between the fourth and fifth toe from the fourth and fifth toe touching or kissing each other. There are four nerves that go to each toe and finger, two on the top, two on the bottom, essentially in the corners. If for some reason the callus or corner, what we call a hyperkeratotic area, gets in the way of this nerve and the nerve gets entangled or meshed in this callus and basically forms an adhesion, the excruciating pain that can result can be because of the nerve entangled in this thick tissue. Identifying the problem and making a proper diagnosis is, of course, the first thing that needs to be done, and then addressing it accordingly. It may be that a spacer needs to be placed between the fourth and fifth toe. It may need to be addressed that the callus needs to be softened and removed. In some cases, an injection of corticosteroid if the nerve is just so inflamed and so aggravated by this long-acting impingement, if you would, from the callus, that the nerve needs to be calmed down. And in some scenarios, the toe may need to be addressed surgically if it is in such an abnormal position causing such discomfort that straightening the toe would, in fact, potentially give curative definitive relief.
What about care of calluses themselves? I have a number of emails that kind of hem and haw around that. I think we can say, or I'm going to conclude what you're saying, is that the callus is there because of friction and irritation. But once they develop, you can do things to decrease the friction. But what else can be done about the callus?
Yeah, well, understanding that callus is a normal physiological response of the skin to friction and pressure. You know, you think of the skin as an organ. It's no different than it's the largest organ in the body by definition. And if you go to the gym and you lift weights and you don't wear gloves and patter up, after a while you're going to get, you know, callus on your hand from the dumbbell or the weight machine. The foot's no different. If there are bony prominences, if there's faulty function, if there's spurring, growth of bone, if the skin is atrophying, meaning it's thinning out over time, you know, callus will develop. So callus, you know, is not this horrible thing. It's a protective measure. It's your body's way of dealing with this stress on the skin in this particular area and trying to thicken to protect itself from breaking down and causing fissures and exposing the body to the outside world and losing that protection of our first barrier of defense being our skin. If the callus becomes painful, then the first thing you want to do is eliminate the force that caused it in the first place with different types of padding techniques or inserts or shoe changes, and then softening the callus with medication creams called keratolytics. Keratin is the outer layer of our body that makes up hair, skin, and nails. When skin thickens, it's called a hyperkeratinosis. So putting on keratolytic medication creams, either over the counter or prescription strength, will in fact soften these areas and in many cases resolve the symptoms. But to say that callus is a pathological thing that must be eliminated, you know, is a little extreme.
Okay, don't. I have another caller. Peggy, you're on line one.
Hello, I just have a question. I have some symptoms that have come up just in the last couple of months, and they're on both feet. I'm fairly active. I'm 63, and I walk about 3 miles a day, and I also lift weights, so I would say I'm fairly healthy. But about 2 months ago, I started exhibiting symptoms in both feet that feels like pins and needles or walking on little bits of sand, and I'm wanting to know if that's a good something that you could address.
Well, my initial impression of what you say is it's a condition called metatarsalgia, and that means activity-induced pain in the ball of the foot. Now, that's not being very specific. That's a very generalized comment. Once we define that someone has metatarsalgia, we then have to take the next step and say, well, why? Is there faulty function of the toe joints? Is there an inflamed bursa? Is there an neuroma that was alluded to earlier by someone's question? And once the diagnosis is made and the treatment is implemented, the primary problem is addressed. The metatarsalgia can go away. Lumps in the ball of the foot are not normal. pins and needles in the front of the foot, with or without activity, are not normal. And these are ailments that can be addressed quite effectively.
And what if it's both in the heel and the ball of the foot?
Well,
does that make a difference?
Well, it would just, again, need to be addressed. Is the issue, they may not be associated, or they may have a correlation. The heel issue could be a variety of things. It could be fasciitis. It could be subcalcaneal bursitis. It could be a pinched nerve. It could be a tarsal tunnel. So, again, it's too general of a question for me to just say, one, two, three.
But this is something I should have looked into.
If it's something you want to change, yeah.
Could this be a neuropathy of some sort?
It could be.
Yeah.
It could be. But
are you on any medications, Peggy, or possibly have diabetes, anything like that?
No, I don't have any diabetes. I don't take any high blood pressure medication. The only thing I've ever taken is vitamins and an antidepressant.
Okay.
Most likely probably mechanical.
Okay. All right. Great.
Thank you.
Thank you for your call.
Bye-bye.
An email, is there any product on the market that softens the toenail to make clipping them less painful? I'm assuming somebody with very thick nails.
Yeah. Well, yeah, onychoxis is the definition of thick nails. Onychomycosis is the definition of thick nails with associated fungus. And the simplest over-the-counter product to soften nails would be Aquaphor or Vaseline. An attempt to treat fungus, tea tree oil, which is a liquid that's available usually in most pharmacy sections or the holistic health food areas of most stores, tea tree oil has been shown to treat fungus. So you could use them in combination, paint on tea tree oil once a day and then apply Aquaphor for maybe 1 week a month, like at night before one goes to bed, put a little bit of the Aquaphor or Vaseline on the nail, cover it up with a clean sock so it doesn't get all over the sheets and, makes it oily and hard to wash. And that will hyperhydrate. There's another condition that leads to thickened nails. It's called dyshidrotic eczema. And that is screaming for moisture creams like Aquaphor or Vaseline. So that's what I would try first on that.
So as a general rule, I've told patients that the thicker the emollient you put on, the better you hold in moisture. The analogy being a plastic Band-Aid traps moisture and you get wet under that. So
yeah.
Lotions aren't as good as creams. Creams aren't as good as ointments and
right.
oils.
But
and that's what you're getting with the
on the On the flip side of that, you could sometimes cause too much by using the ointment. And then there's this theory about, we take a bath, soak your feet. You're looking at about 10 minutes. If you can soak your feet or take a bath, 10, 15 minutes at max, then if you put the cream on, you're going to lock in moisture. If you do it more than that, you're actually losing that benefit.
Okay. Boy, what a fast hour, and thanks for being so thorough. Our guest today was Dr. Ken Swayman, one of the Anchorage podiatrists. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Ted.
Next week, we're going to return to neurology, and we're going to interview Anchorage neurologist Dr. Frank Ellenson, and we'll discuss multiple sclerosis. This is the most common progressive neurologic disorder affecting adults in the world. I want to thank Kristen Spack for engineering today's program, Dr. Swayman for being so thorough, all the callers that called in to keep me from having to talk too much, and Beattie Trentina for the Ricola lozenges that made me not cough except once. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection, is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.